the Jewish community. Just as another example. How long ago was it, again, 30, 40 years ago, when prominent rabbis were asked whether women could say Kaddish in a synagogue, within the framework of a minyan? And they all said no. And they said no for a variety of halachic reasons. It's not sanua, it's not modest. Kol be'isha erva, the halachic issues, even if she's speaking or not. Singing. The Baron Soloveitchik was certainly not a Makir, the brother of Rav Yoshe Ber. In one of his books of Tshuvot, he writes that he permits women to say Kaddish in the synagogue. And he even justifies it by saying that, in a sort of a negative way, that if we don't permit it, then it's very clear that she'll gravitate towards the sort of religious framework which we see as a negative one. In other words, they'll become conservatives or reform. This is a sort of a negative justification. Nonetheless, he was an extreme machmir. And nonetheless, he realized that there was no halachic reason not to permit women to do so. And he said that it should be permitted under the present circumstances. Rav Ovadia, again, has a tshuva, as he has a tshuva on every major issue. And he clarifies the issue even further. And he says that there isn't a question of Kol Be'isha Erva in the framework of a synagogue, because there isn't B'davar Shebekedusha Ein Mishum Chiba. I won't go into the halachic meanings of this, but that's the way he formulates it. And he says that therefore those women, again, who have genuine spiritual personal requirements, they need to express themselves in this fashion, should be permitted to do so. He doesn't say that all women automatically ought to say Kaddish and Shul. Those that need to. Now, this type of justification goes back to very early sources. There exist proper halachic precedents for this. The standard sources that are usually cited begin with the Mishnah and the Talmud. A person that brought an offering to the Beit HaMikdash had to place his hands upon that offering before it was sacrificed. That's called smicha. Women, according to biblical law, strictly speaking, were not permitted to do so. There's a machloket of the Tanaim whether women should be permitted to do so or not, and the ruling is that Anashim somchot mishum ogmat nefesh. Women are permitted to do so because otherwise they would feel pain, grief, and anguish, that they didn't have this type of role, active role, in bringing their own korbanot. There's a famous tshuva of the Ramo, the Moshe Yisrael, in which he permitted a wedding to take place on Shabbat, which previously had never been permitted. And he says, "Inyan zeh kayotze bo umishum agmat nefesh." I have to permit it because this woman, who this girl, she was a yetomah, she was an orphan, and the delay of her wedding to a later date would have caused her extreme shame and grief. And we cannot permit such an event, such a ruling which would hurt her in such a fashion. In a similar type of halachic approach, it tells a story in the Radbaz of David ben Zimra, who was a contemporary of the of Rabbi Yosef Karo, lived in Egypt. He tells a story about a man whose wife was sterile and couldn't bear children, so he took a second wife. He was in Egypt, in the Oriental communities, and she bore him a number of children. And then he decided he wanted to divorce the woman who bore the children, but to keep the children for himself. And the Radbaz writes, "Inyan kayotze ba yesh baze ogmot nefesh." Such an activity would cause great grief to the woman. Lo orach ara lezilzulei benot Yisrael kulei hai. It's not our way. It's not the Jewish way. It's not the halachic way to lezalzel, to not l'shem. Let's call it to shame benot Yisrael to such an extent. Lishloach ha'em ve'et habanim yikach lach, based on the verse, to send away the woman and to keep the children. V'gadol kvod abriyot shetokhe lo taseh b'Torah. The dignity of the individual is of such great halachic import that it even can at times counter a biblical commandment. There are more of these examples. This question of causing mental grief, anguish to men or to women, which we call kvod habriyot, is a very basic notion in Jewish law. The halakha permitted women, men who were not continent or who had problems with their urinary tract to come to synagogue and to participate, even though they had one of these sacks attached to them. Now, halachically, that's very problematic. The justification was that we cannot shame a person to the extent of not permitting him to enter the synagogue and to participate. The Blazer Waldenberg, a contemporary Meshiv, was asked about the problem of hearing aids on Shabbat. Halachically, a complicated issue. You know, sometimes they whistle, sometimes they have to be adjusted. And he says that they're permitted on Shabbat under certain circumstances. And he says, because we cannot countenance the idea of an Orthodox Jew not being permitted to come to shul and to participate in the ceremony, because if in the service, because if he comes without his hearing aid, he won't be able to hear the tefillah, he won't be able to hear Kriyat HaTorah, he won't know where he is, he'll be shamed, he'll be hurt, he'll be anguished. V'gadol kvod habriyot. And the dignity of the individual is of paramount importance. Now, the individuals are not necessarily deaf people or people that have some sort of a medical problem. There are also women who have spiritual demands, genuine spiritual demands, not political agendae, but women that feel that they want to have a greater participation, that want to express themselves religiously within frameworks which are halachically acceptable, and don't want to be relegated to behind the mechitza through which they cannot see anything and through which it's difficult for them to hear anything. Now, there's a well-known story by the Chida, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in the 18th century, where he tells how he went to a shul in central Spain. He says that there was a woman's minyan not a minyan, a prayer group. Tells the town in which it was. And he describes how it was. So there was a shul, and there was a cellar underneath the shul. And in this cellar, there was in the floor of the shul, there was a grating, like a window with grating. And the only light that came into this cellar came through this grating. And the women used to daven downstairs in this cellar. And because they couldn't hear anything from the upstairs shul, with the men, and because they couldn't see anything, they had a rabbi to lead the service. He was blind. So there was a time when that was the position that women were given within the synagogue. In medieval times, there were women that weren't permitted to come into a synagogue if they were menstruants, benidah. I won't go into the history of that halachic issue. I've discussed it elsewhere and shown that it's based on misunderstandings of certain texts. In later times, halachists said that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when everybody comes to shul, and everybody comes into shul, we will permit the women to come in, even if they're menstruant, because otherwise they will have agmat nefesh, v'gadol kvod abriyot. So even in extreme negative circumstances, this constituted a basic halachic tenet which could be used in all sorts of frameworks. We see then that traditionally, as I began, when there were halachic challenges, there were also halachic solutions offered. And these halachic solutions were based on sources which were examined, as Rav Weinberg says, intellectually, argued carefully, examined, and solutions were offered. They weren't necessarily accepted by everybody. There were discussions over them. They were modified repeatedly. Should be borne in mind that many of our standard takanot went through a whole process of refinement. The Heter Iska was rewritten in almost every generation from the 15th century onwards to the ones that we use in the banks in Israel nowadays. The Heter Mechirat Karka, the Heter for agricultural activities in Israel during the sabbatical year, has gone through 250 years of change, refinement, from the Rabbanei Chevron in the 18th century through the Heter Tarmat in 1889 in Jerusalem, through the refinements of Rav Kook Zatzal in the 30s and Shabbat Haaretz, until the present day situation, which have been further refined by various rabbinic authorities. So things don't necessarily happen overnight, and they don't happen in one go, and they happen as a process. And the process is necessary because it's not easy to readjust. We're all frightened of change. We all know that there's dangers in change. And we all have this feeling that if you make an alteration over here, the effect is going to be felt over there. It's like the conservationists say. You know, you smoke, you have pollution in Europe, and it's going to affect the Philippines. And that's true. So you have to take into account the broader repercussions and implications of whatever you're doing. But traditionally, this is what always took place. And when there's a societal change which is very clear and which expresses itself in all sorts of aspects of cultural behavior, then the halakha has to recognize that fact. And if there emerges a clear and dangerous, religiously dangerous, tension between these two phenomena, between the conservative halakha and the innovative societal changes, then our halachists have to bravely review the sources and see how they can find solutions. And as I said, they did. And if we have courage, and if we're not frightened to say what we feel is right, and if we're sufficiently learned and also intelligent to view the situation and the sources, we will come up with halachically acceptable solutions which will also be humanly acceptable. And in this way, we will be able to keep within the confines of what we call modern Orthodox society a greater number of our members who would otherwise be driven outside these confines in directions which we do not see as positive. So in order to preserve Orthodox Judaism, in order to strengthen it, in order to make it more viable, in order to ensure its future, we have to be brave, outspoken, halachically acceptable, but creative in our thought. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. What I'm going to do now, we're going to take between 10 and 15 minutes of questions, just so you don't have to get all nervous and know when to leave. And then he's here all weekend. Dr. Sperber's here all weekend. He'll be speaking actually at Sher Shemaim over Shabbos for those who live in the South. But what we'll do is I will ask everybody to make a statement, a question, not a statement. Please keep it under a minute, and we'll take maybe 3-4 questions in a row if that's okay, and then he can answer them in one shot. And I'm going to do something I usually don't, but I'm going to initiate the question in period. And I just want to follow up. You mentioned how Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was in favor of Kaddish because he was afraid if he didn't allow it, this is the part you didn't mention, women would advocate for aliyot in shuls. And as I think is well known, you have written and spoken that that's, I don't know at what stage we are. It's clearly not in a forbidden stage. Either you believe we're in the stage where it's okay, or it's actually a mitzvah to advocate it, as you developed in our bat mitzvah. And I'd like you to develop that notion, knowing full well how the majority of the Orthodox world is clearly opposed to it, many, you know, vehemently. And how should we approach, how you feel this issue should be approached and developed in the future? So that is my question. I'll put the microphone in the middle, and if 3 or 4 people would like to come up and ask questions, under 1 minute, please. No statements.
Two-part question, but it's one question. Is mechitza halacha? And if so, what are the sources?
You mentioned ogmat nefesh, anguish, and also the particular motivation. In other words, is a woman or a group of women trying to make a political statement, or are they spiritually motivated? And I'm wondering how you would exercise judgment in these kind of cases. I know that, you know, for myself personally, it's always often very difficult for me to figure out why I'm motivated to do a particular thing. I'd imagine it's even more difficult for a rabbi to figure out why I'm motivated to do a particular thing, and even more difficult if he's trying to figure out why a whole group of women are motivated to do a particular thing. So how does one decide whether a woman who's motivated, say, to do something, which coincidentally all the Reform and Conservative have just started doing, whether she's motivated to do that because she sees what they're doing and she thinks that it's a good idea and it looks attractive, or because she feels it'll bring her closer to God, or because it's some combination, and if it's some combination, which percentage of what would permit that kind of innovation?
Sorry, Dr. Sperber, I guess I'll go in the order in which the questions were raised. And in a sense, some of them relate to one another. Question of Aliyot. What I tried to demonstrate in my own writings was, A, that women's Aliyot are halachically totally permissible, that this is clearly stated in the Gemara and in the Tosefta, Hakol Ksherim Lalot LaTorah, Aval Amru Chachamim, etc. That the Maram Mirotenburg, who I think was a fairly significant posek, ruled that under certain circumstances women were to have Aliyot LaTorah, that the Rishonim, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Meiri, etc., discussed whether they could do so just for the middle Aliyot, or whether they could also get Rishon and Achron. That was a time when the first and the last person made Brachot. They all agreed that there shouldn't be a situation where only women get Aliyot, but they all took it for granted that women could get Aliyot. However, this hasn't been done for many hundreds of years in most communities. And therefore, there is a minhag of a negative nature not to do this. The question is whether the absence of a particular activity constitutes a minhag which has become mandatory. And the answer I offer halachically is something which Rav Kook writes in a very significant statement in Shabbat Haaretz, where he says that something which is permissible halachically and has not happened, has not been practiced over the years, is not halachically forbidden. Just that. Ein isur lechadesh davar muvtal shelo nahagu bo ad arshav. There is no prohibition to innovate a practice which is halachically permitted, even though it hasn't been practiced in the past. I therefore said that if there would be a situation where a congregation is developing anew from the start, and where all elements of that congregation, men and women, husbands and wives, agree that they want women to play a more active role in the community, including Aliyot, etc., then there isn't a question of Kvod HaTzibur, isn't a question that in any way this is going to shame the male members. And there is an issue of Kvod HaBriot. There is an issue of the dignity of the individual woman who wants to have this practice. Kvod HaBriot is a chiyuv d'oraita. Kvod HaTzibur is a custom and not even an issue of the Rabbanan, as I tried to demonstrate. Therefore, I said that I wasn't advocating that everybody should start having Aliyot, and I certainly didn't think that in any community where the significant majority, or not majority, a significant number of the community would object to it. I mean, we want Achdut, we don't want Pirud. I don't think that this should be instituted. But when you're creating a new community with a new model, then I think that this should be seriously considered as a halachically acceptable option. This, in a sense, leads me to the question that was the last question that was asked. How do you distinguish between the intentions of a group of people or individuals who wish to make such innovations? Not that I have an answer to this, but let's look at the situation from a realistic, practical point of view. My daughter, she, after she did Sheirut Lumi for 2 years, She went and studied in a midrasha in Migdal Oz for 3 years. She studied Torah, she studied halacha. I examined her, and she was very good. And then she went to the university. She davens 3 times a day. She's married, has a position, works in the middle of the desert just near Yericho in a new, newly established community, a small community of 7 couples. They just have a minyan on Shabbos. Nobody can go away for Shabbos. Unless they find somebody else to take their place. She davens 3 times a day. She wouldn't miss it. Somebody that's that motivated, that's willing to learn 3 years intensively Torah without getting any sort of paper for qualifications, didn't come out with any diploma, knows that she's delaying her ability to earn and become independent for that amount of time after 2 years in Shul Klali, and is so clearly religious that she wouldn't miss a mincha or a ma'ariv, I think that in that case you know that this is not some sort of political agenda. But when women who barely come to shul on Shabbos stand up and say, we want, then I suspect that there is a political agenda, maybe a justifiable one. So we cannot examine the hearts and the souls of people. But in all too many cases, there are clear evidence, objective evidence. In Israel, you see these young couples. The boy studied in Hesder for 5 years, in the army, in Hesder. The girl, his wife, studied in one of the midrashot for a few years. They can both learn. They can learn together. They sit together in a chavuta. They learn Chumash, Rashi, Parshat HaShavua. My daughter, this daughter, does Shtai Mikra Ve'echad Rashi every week with her husband. So, when you see a group of people of this nature, and there aren't many of these groups, that get together and they decide that they want to build a new type of model, Kehila, and they want a greater participation and a greater degree of egalitarianism, and they go to rabbis to ask what is permitted and what is not, then I think we can be fairly convinced that there is a genuine spiritual desire as opposed to some sort of a political agenda. Question of mechitza. The question of mechitza is complicated. It's complicated for a number of reasons. In the temple, there was no mechitza. There was an Ezrat Nashim, a women's section, and beyond that, further inwards, there was an Ezrat Gvarim. So every male that wanted to go into the temple to bring a sacrifice had to walk through the Ezrat Nashim. And there was no distinction between them. I mean, there was a difference of height, but they had to walk through. I mentioned the fact that women were permitted to do smicha. They used to bring their korbanot, korban yoledet, etc. The only time when there was any clear separation of the sexes was during the festival of Sukkot, when they made a tikkun gadol and they made some sort of a balcony so that the women should be separated from the men. But the reason given there in the Gemara in Masechet Megillah is because the men used to go berserk, because they used to dance and do somersaults and juggle with extreme joy on Simchat Beit HaShoeva. On such occasions, when there was extreme physical, joyful activities, they felt that there should be a separation of the sexes. Other than that, there was no separation. In medieval times, for a totally different reason, there were no mechitzot in the shuls. The reason was because women were not in the same building as the men. The women had a vaidar shield. It was a separate building, a separate room, not just a cellar with a grating. The old shuls that we have, the only surviving old shuls in Europe, are Worms from the 10th to 11th century, and the Altnoy Shul in Prague. It didn't happen in Ezrat Nashim. The Altnoy Shul in Prague, the Ezrat Nashim was built in the 16th century. The shul itself was built in the 11th century. And the walls between the present Ezrat Nashim and between the present Ezrat Gvarim, 1.5 meters thick, and they have these sort of tunnels. So there's no way that a woman anyhow can see what's going on in the main sanctuary. And in the Rishonim, they tell us that the women used to have their own sections, and they used to have somebody that led them in prayer, and they were called Ferzogerin. The Ferzogerin was a woman who used to be a chazanit. She led the prayers, and the prayers were usually in Yiddish in Europe because the women didn't know Hebrew, most of them couldn't read. And the descriptions that we have are very interesting. The women, there were indications to them when they should cry. They all came with their handkerchiefs, and they cried at certain intervals of the prayer because that's when they were told that's the time to cry. This was genuine prayer. It was a different type of style. Then, again, for historical sociological problems, reasons that I won't go into, the women were brought into the synagogue. They were first brought into the synagogue in Italy during the Renaissance period. Well, Italy was a sort of a culture in its own right. It was unique. I mean, Italy is the first place that we know where Jews used to hang self-portraits in their houses, Orthodox Jews. When Michelangelo did his famous David, who's not really terribly modest, and who sits in San Pietro, which is not a terribly Jewish place, Vasari, who wrote this, one of the great artists, writes that there were streams of Jews that went to visit and to see and to admire David. I can't imagine that taking place in Germany, for example, at the same time. So Italy was the first place where women, and incidentally, in Italy they had women who were mohalot and women who were shochtot. And we have from the Renaissance period, we have documents of hasmacha for women to act as women that do the milah and the do shrita. And that was, again, for various reasons. There were small scattered communities, and they were too far apart, and they couldn't have people coming all the time, and so on and so forth. So Italy is a unique situation where women were brought into the synagogue. And our first balconies appear in Italian synagogues. And that's, of course, patterned on what it says in the Mishnah Megillah, Asu achsadra, etc., Greek word, meaning a balcony. And that's where you get the sort of the women's section upstairs. It was only later, much later, that they developed the sort of single level shul with mechitzot to separate the men and the women. So from a historical point of view, one can show that the mechitza is a relatively late phenomenon, not mentioned at all in the Shulchan Aruch. It wasn't mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch because there was no need for it, because the women weren't in the same building. So you can't really learn a halachic conclusion from the absence, because there were reasons for this, but it doesn't exist in the Shulchan Aruch. On the other hand, there exist sources from the medieval period, from the Byzantine period, from the 6th or the 7th century, from Eretz Israel, and not from Babel, which makes statements to the effect that during ritual activities, men and women should be separated. Again, this is not a simple thing, because during certain events that took place, it's stated that the man, the woman, and the child would come together to the temple.